The logical construct behind the dissection of today's evils is actually very simple. Money is broken. Fix the money, fix the world. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. We've got another great piece from Bitcoin Magazine today. Thibald Marichal, who is a many-time author now on the show, he genuinely almost always just has a really fascinating piece on Bitcoin Audible. And this one makes the cut too. Just a really good one. It's titled, When Bitcoin Melts the System, Prosperity Steps In, and it's a really good one. So we're going to dive right into it. A quick thank you before we do to Hexa Wallet for supporting the show. They are bringing the best in Bitcoin in audio to you so that you can listen to it. And they are also bringing you a fantastic mobile wallet with multiple accounts. Built-in batching, non-custodial, privacy-preserving, and you don't have to give them any account information. Seedless backup, Bitcoin-only wallet. So check them out at hexawallet.io, and if you want to add me as a contact or have me as part of your backup system, feel free to DM me. Open on Twitter, at TheCryptoEconomy, or at Bitcoin Audible. You can reach me at both. Just shoot me a message. I'd love to be a contact and or part of your backup system. With that, let's go ahead and jump into our Bitcoin Magazine article for today by Thibald Marichal, titled, When Bitcoin Melts the System, Prosperity Steps In. Overcome by the giddiness that flying lent him, Icarus soared into the sky. But in the process, he came too close to the sun, which, due to the heat, melted the wax. The Legend of Icarus. Central banking, along with fractional reserve banking, two inseparable evils of monetary policies, have been distorting market price signals for the last 50 years. In 1971, the Nixon shock corrupted the global monetary system by fracturing the final linkage between gold and the U.S. dollar. Fiat currencies were unleashed, issued and managed by central banks. Over the years, delusional interventionism, enabled by politicized narratives to serve a middle class convinced into believing central manipulation is in their best interest, has brought fiat currency's purchasing power to its knees. Today, savers are penalized, while speculators and spenders are rewarded. This tendency to be punished by lowering one's time preference feels alienating to many. It just doesn't feel right. Yet few are capable of putting a finger on why that is, including banking professionals and money managers whose salaries depend on not understanding it. With a dysfunctional monetary system that doesn't hold value over time, many artificial distortions arise in all markets. Like a cancer metastasizing in its host, fiat currencies are the initial viral load that contaminated all territories governed by the fiat dogma, spreading the pandemic of central and fractional reserve banking. A misunderstood sister. It is a well-understood yet underappreciated fact that money accounts for 50% of the value of all transactions globally, and therefore a broken money can have severe repercussions as it tricks every user into misleading economic calculus, ultimately leading to a distorted, apathetic, and broken society. The logical construct behind the dissection of today's evils is actually very simple. Money is broken. Fix the money, fix the world. Time is an invariably forward passage common to all humans, agnostic to status, wealth, ethnicity, or location. We only have so much of it. Money is an instrument to store time for later use, ready for trade with other specialized individuals. With money acting as a neutral good for trade, everyone is more productive with their special craft, the beauty of the specialization of labor. All voluntary and peaceful human action that emerges as part of a free society is enabled by money, a neutral good for exchange within a capitalistic society, a system built on the ability to accumulate capital for later productive use and to do good around oneself. What happens if money decays faster than time, melting away the time people have accrued? How is the common man affected psychologically by a devaluing currency? How do assets behave when people store their savings using them to preserve their wealth? How are industries and markets structurally influenced when being close to money production is highly profitable? How will narratives around inflationary, quote, growth at all cost compare to peaceful deflationary realities where individuals earn more by waiting patiently? What happens when sound money is finally restored to the people using free and open tools such as Bitcoin? In this brief exploration, we will raise fundamental questions around national monetary manipulation with fiat currencies, their effects on life, business, and psychology, and how a global monetary melting led by Bitcoin will drastically shift the world toward sustained deflation, the ultimate step toward unrestrained prosperity and abundance. So hop on. Saving is freedom. People save to plan for future uncertainty and enjoyment. A dad may want to save to feed his family tomorrow in case of an unplanned job loss, or to organize a family trip for the next holiday. A young person may want to save to build a business. Saving is the essence of all human life. It allows one to construct a well-balanced life. Without savings, a man is bound to get stuck on a never-ending hamster wheel, chasing his shadow. Savings are the root of all capital accumulation that serve as the base of life and investing, which leads to productivity improvements if done well. Doing more with less is great, and that's what life is all about, starting with biological evolution. A more productive dad can spend more time with his kids and wife. A more productive fungus has more room to grow and take over a larger territory. That's all pretty basic, yet fundamental. Tweet from Thibault Marichal, the author. Quote, "Bring back sound money, bring back savings. Bring back savings, bring back peace of mind. Bring back peace of mind, bring back families. Bring back families, bring back entrepreneurship. Bring back entrepreneurship, and you bring back prosperity. Bitcoin is peace, love, and prosperity." When money decays over time and fails to hold value, something odd happens. People feel the need to spend it quickly because they can get more with it immediately compared to holding it for later use. Holding a devaluing money presents a penalty to a responsible saver. Better spend it and buy other goods and services, or invest it in a yield-generating asset to preserve wealth over time, or at least offset the inflation rate. The root problem lies in the forceful decision of spending instead of voluntary saving. With monetary inflation, people will tend to buy things they don't need and invest in stuff they don't understand. The resulting artificial demand for goods and services is unnatural and triggers many ills such as asset and consumer price inflation. Industries end up being built by producers responding to these artificially stimulated price signals, which cause systemic malinvestment, the scale of which we have yet to fathom. Industries built on fiat vice. Governments today measure economic development with a national metric called the GDP, which necessarily relies on consumption of goods as one of its primary drivers. Consumption means spending, which lowers savings, and because savings is the basis of investing via gradual capital accumulation, it is easy to see how flawed a focus on GDP is. Two great evils have emerged from fiat currencies and government-led measurements of economic progress: consumerism and short-sighted financial engineering. entire industries have been built on a delusional vision for mankind corrupted by debt-fueled consumerism. Overzealous application of financial engineering is the atrocity pushing the boundaries of exuberance when it comes to enslaving our lives. Buy things we don't need, consume, with money we don't have, debt. If people were consuming less because money was holding value over time, would advertisers spend around $700 billion per year to promote goods and services? Would social media platforms be tracking their users and manipulating individual views as much as they are to serve advertising giants? Would the world's best software engineers spend their precious time architecting machine learning models to optimize online ad spend? Would the smartest pool of talent spend outrageous hours in financial services, losing the most precious hours of their youth with little societal benefit to show for it? Global banking is estimated to be worth roughly $5.3 trillion. As one of the most well-paying industries, banking and financial services are attracting millions of workers, accounting for around 23% of the total global workforce, including talented software engineers and developers with the ability to horizontally move to other industries. Creating a massive industry, the growth of banking is a direct result of the corrupted fiat currency system, which incentivizes the construction of ever more complicated financial engineering schemes. All this to protect wealth from centrally induced inflation, deemed necessary by those who benefit from its existence, which for everyone else ultimately only serves to increase systemic risk until an eventual rupture leads to socialized losses, bailouts. Facebook, Google, YouTube, and Amazon are advertising companies, under the semblance of speech-enhancing global social networks, receiving close to 40% of the global ad spend. Roughly $618 billion was spent by advertisers on these platforms last year alone, which incentivizes these companies to track their users as much as they possibly can to serve their paying customers, advertisers. Talented engineers are attracted to these companies, not to support free speech at a massive scale as social media could allow, but because the pays are indeed quite generous, with a median pay of $250,000 at Google. In a sense, banking and advertising are truly important industries, which most definitely can add value to the world, but have been corrupted by the evil of fiat monetary inflation, to the point that benevolence is no longer possible. Advertising and banking are dominating global economic activity, while they ought to be supporting well-functioning free markets. A dark and invisible beast. First and foremost, monetary inflation is an expansion of the money supply. Monetary inflation renders all previously existing circulating units less valuable by diluting their presence in the total supply. Currency holders lose purchasing power due to inflation, which encourages them to get rid of it, as we just discussed, affecting many aspects of life, such as time preference. Instant gratification feels good, and intrinsically, all biological organisms enjoy pleasure in the short term, knowing that long-term pain may occur as a result. Take a night out with friends drinking. Sipping that extra glass of bourbon is undeniably enjoyable in the moment, but the next morning may not be so pleasant. Rationally, if someone knows that saving money for later use will render this money more valuable, the incentive to not spend it right away is strikingly obvious. What happens then? Demand for unnecessary items may contract as people reduce their spending. People may start thinking twice about their willingness to spend the money they earned with hard work. Do I really want to buy the latest pair of Nikes or the newest iPhone? This simple shift of mindset seems inconsequential at first, but it leads to a rippling societal change, a complete reversal of current norms plagued by overconsumption of frivolities. Allowing someone to reflect before making a decision to deny future wealth appreciation is a fundamental restructuring of the individual psyche. Delayed consumption lends space to think rationally, preventing superficial consumption. Instead of consuming life in the short term, one invests in their life for the long term. How does reliable and scarce money affect the human psyche? How does an individual change when exposed to delicate scarcity as opposed to extravagant abundance? What happens to a society protected by incorruptible assurances of sound money? A reversal of the human psyche. A rolling stone gathers no moss. Living a carefree life that is not built on solid foundations is unstable. Like a stone in the forest under the trees, the moss that accumulates is synonymous with a fresh and healthy environment where time passes. A stone that tumbles in the river at the mercy of currents will not accumulate any moss, a torrential existence of misery. Individuals are no different. Stability and prosperity come from a foundation built on a secure shelter, a decent nutrition, a healthy lifestyle, a loving family, caring friends, incorruptible values, and generous savings for cold, rainy days. Not having that unshakable foundation can lead to a life of misery with no meaningful accomplishment. All valuable things are scarce, and money is no different. Something abundantly available has little value. Water in an ocean doesn't have much value, but in a deserted area, it can mean life or death. As individuals are exposed to truly scarce money, overconsumption stops. Today, this phenomenon is observed in reverse, fueled by massive consumer and corporate debt levels, the polar opposite of low time preference. People are spending their future in the present by neglecting the burden of debt and borrowing large sums of money to pay for items they cannot afford. Education in the U.S. is an obscene illustration of that for young adults, with 44 million students collectively owing $1.6 trillion of debt for their university degrees. American mortgage debt is nearing $10 trillion, which is propping up the real estate market in an unsustainable fashion. In total for the U.S. alone, consumer debt reached $14 trillion, while the corporate debt market hit $10.5 trillion earlier this year. Prior to the massive wave of stimulus led by governments all around the world, the sovereign debt market already hit an all-time high of $66 trillion, more than approximately 80% of global GDP. Overall, global debt-fueled growth is a symptom of an illness in the money that we use globally, no different to the effect felt by individuals. As mentioned earlier, a man with sound money lowers his time preference, facing the irrefutable scarcity of his storehold of wealth. As his savings appreciate in value over time, he can wonder about what he should be spending his time and money on next. He is now allowed to think before acting, instead of running on life's proverbial treadmill. Getting rid of superfluous possessions is the number one priority. Leaving behind a life of frivolous spending hidden by the vicious ornament of carpe diem, this newly born man discovers the timeless prosperity of Stoicism. Patience, devotion, and loyalty suddenly emerge from the dust as strong values upon which he can build his reasoning. Learning to appreciate the beauty of things around him, this man's heart fills with love and empathy for others around him who are still on the treadmill. Few things truly matter, and chief among those that do are his family, his health, and his life's work to make things better around him. Sound money changed him. A fast life of abundance filled with comfort and certainty now feels shallow and miserable. Progress made through work, pain, and love allows him to tackle uncertainty and find stability in the chaos of life. As he delays his own gratification, to plan for his family or entrepreneurial venture, he reduces his consumption, accumulating liquid reserves. Savings allows him to be free, and because they are appreciating in purchasing power over time, the more patient he is, the more reward he inevitably reaps. What happens if this effect on the individual spreads to society? As people demand less of products and services under a Bitcoin standard, but also reduce their speculation in asset classes to preserve their wealth, a global deflation flourishes, allowing individuals and families to attain increasing purchasing power, further driving society toward prosperity. A global deflationary repricing. When consumer behavior shifts, producers undoubtedly adapt their output to meet the new demand. If there is a demand shock, prices will plummet until buyers are found, such that producers can distribute their past production and readjust their upcoming production cycle to meet lower demand levels. Producing less, entrepreneurs and organizations can focus on quality over volume, which should create more value for the buyers, perhaps willing to pay more for the products and services they are receiving, bringing prices back to an equilibrium. In a society with sound money, where monetary production is locked away from the greedy minds of fallible humans, such as is the case with Bitcoin, consumption slows down. As mentioned, faced with inalterable scarcity, individuals understand the cost of instant gratification. Suddenly, frivolous spending ceases to be common, because it ends up being so costly in the future. When cash reserves appreciate over time, products and services become more affordable, and individuals along with businesses end up spending later to enjoy a higher purchasing power. Inflation may turn negative. Many investment strategies built on the mandate to preserve wealth and capital for the long term may turn obsolete as a result. Positive real returns today represent a key driver for long-term portfolio managers who are mandated to protect capital from inflation erosion over multiple decades. What happens when inflation turns negative? In such a scenario, cash doesn't lose purchasing power. The well-known, quote, cash is trash, popularized by hedge fund superstar Ray Dalio, becomes a slogan of the past. Suddenly, cash is restored with a fundamentally important property of sound money, a lasting storehold of wealth. In a sound money society, cash is not only the most liquid, saleable asset, acting as a medium of exchange and measure of value, but it acts as a store of value. Anyone willing to solely preserve wealth over time and have access to liquidity to meet short and medium-term obligations only has to hold cash. For trillions of dollars of capital parked in assets to preserve wealth over time, this represents a drastic shift. Bitcoin is the instrument which may turn the world upside down, reversing investment strategies for many asset managers across the world. As Bitcoin maintains a steady cadence in its process of monetization, it will continue to absorb a material amount of wealth from the fiat legacy paradigm, plagued with inflation and currency debasement until total collapse. Some would argue that such a particular view is extreme, while others would maintain that it is absurd and ignorant not to hold it. As this process proceeds and Bitcoin attains unfathomable levels of market value, asset classes such as real estate, gold, and equities will be repriced. Fundamental valuation models for the classes of assets exist today and are well understood. Undeniably, today, most of these asset classes are deemed to be overpriced by multiple investment managers looking to find value in underpriced assets. Truth be told, most of these assets have accrued a monetary premium, which emanates from their respective utility as decent storeholds of wealth. An asset that is understood by the market as a viable store of value is relatively scarce compared to the currency from which the saver is trying to find protection, while also being quite durable over time. Real estate is an asset class estimated to be worth $280 trillion and owes a material amount of this aggregate market valuation to the storehold of wealth use case. Indeed, many investors are parking capital in buildings of popular capital cities to preserve their wealth, often leaving their units vacant, as is the case in Vancouver. In other words, the utility of real estate as a good for shelter is not leveraged in this scenario, but only in the fact that urban properties are relatively scarce and durable in politically stable jurisdictions. Equities behave according to the same principles. As a market of roughly $90 trillion today, they are mostly well understood with valuation models such as price-to-earnings ratios. Generally speaking, over a certain threshold, based on the industry and other factors, a company will be deemed overpriced or undervalued. Most equities today are used in diversified 60-40 portfolio allocation strategies to preserve wealth against the erosion of fiat. Fixed income markets are another massive segment used for wealth preservation, especially T-bills, which are deemed, quote, risk-free by some market participants. What happens when investors withdraw from these asset classes to hold wealth-preserving cash? Most likely, a massive burst will follow. The monetary premium accrued over years of weak fiat currencies will be shifted back by a sound money standard, pushing investors outside of risk-on positions to preserve wealth. Investment will be made to derive a return on capital, not only to beat inflation from fiat currencies. In its early phase of monetization, Bitcoin as a global monetary base may capture significant portions of the aggregated monetary premium accrued by different asset classes over the last decades of fiat currency experimentation. As these asset classes are repriced by markets, free of artificial fiat monetary inflation, purchasing power will be restored to the people. One may wonder how long it may take for Bitcoin to become the world's dominant numeraire, the underlying unit of measurement of value that we collectively use to price assets and consumer goods. How much will markets such as real estate, stocks, and gold shrink by if Bitcoin absorbs their cumulative monetary premiums? How will consumption patterns change for individuals and businesses evolving under a deflationary Bitcoin standard? How will humans refocus their time and energy if massive industries such as advertising and financial services are reduced by 30%? What about 70%? Will humans get to Mars much quicker if the best talent can focus on rocket engineering instead of ads optimization? All these are fascinating questions that we may attempt to answer another time. And that concludes Tibald's amazing article. Just hit so many points on the shifting of the psyche and kind of giving that story version of the time preference shift from fiat money to sound money. And there's a lot of quotes that I saved through this one as I was reading through to hit some points on. Real quick, though, before we do, let's hit our sponsor, Hexawallet. You know them, you love them, and if you have not downloaded the wallet yet to start playing with it, you've got to. It really is an awesome wallet. You have multiple accounts with multiple degrees of security. They've got multi-sig built into a savings account. They've got your generic one signature or one key checking account. And the coolest feature that they have that I will never stop raving about is built-in batching. If you added me as a contact or wanted to send money to your savings account or to your Lightning wallet at the same time that you were sending money to a friend, you could literally just keep scanning addresses, you know, scan a Breeze address, scan click on your savings account, select multiple of your contacts, and you can save tons on fees by sending all of these transactions at the exact same time. And it is simple as clicking and adding a person or a address and an amount. It literally feels like the future of mainnet Bitcoin. So if you haven't checked it out, you really got to. And don't forget to hit me up if you want me to be a contact. I am totally open to. I've done it for a lot of people now. And since the wallet is still in beta, they love any feedback so they can help improve and see where it is that you are having problems and shoot me any questions. I always send it forward to the team over there because they are constantly improving and adding new features as it goes. So don't forget to check them out at hexawallet.io, or you can just find them on the Google Play and Apple App Store. Really easy, H-E-X-A, and give them a shout out on my behalf for supporting Bitcoin Audible. All right, so this article is just packed with goodies. this is a topic that if you've ever listened to the show, you know, like I go seriously deep on this one. And I'll actually try to keep this to a minimum today just because I've done it so many times. But this really does have some really interesting little points to add. And I'm already a little late on it here. So let's start with a quote towards the beginning. It says, "The root problem lies in the forceful decision of spending instead of voluntary saving. With monetary inflation, people will tend to buy things they don't need and invest in stuff they don't understand. The resulting artificial demand for goods and services is unnatural and triggers many ills, such as asset and consumer price inflation. Industries end up being built by producers responding to these artificially stimulated price signals, which cause systemic malinvestment, the scale of which we have yet to fathom." This is something that's so hard for people to wrap their head around, is that when you have a systemic imbalance, when you have something that at the very foundational level incentivizes people to change their economic behavior, the market, the entire market from the ground up, will shift to malinvest toward that incentive. They will adjust to account for that. And when you are able to manipulate 50% of the economy, which is what the money is, it is one half of every transaction in the world. Money is the good which allows us to trade all other goods. When that can be manipulated, when that is socially controlled through a central monopolistic institution that controls its prices, that controls its cost across time, that has the sole monopolistic power to counterfeit it, it poisons everything in the market. Nothing is untouched. It is the foundation that everything else is built on. And that includes culture. That includes the perspective that the people in that environment actually have about economic decisions. All economic calculation is poisoned. There's no like special thing that like, oh, because I'm buying a car, it's different and it's not, I'm not being affected by the manipulation of the money. Literally everything, it starts at the money and then everything is built on top of that. He talks about in this piece about the hamster wheel that the economy is basically built on. Everybody's stuck in this treadmill where it feels like no one's making any headway, where we're constantly just spinning our wheels and not going anywhere. And I talked about this before on the show, is that that hamster wheel is built out of fiat. It only exists because of the monetary system we are in. And when that leads to malinvestment, when that leads to the creation of entire industries that could not be sustained otherwise, we are talking about tens of trillions of dollars of misappropriated capital. And what's funny is it's out in the open. It's so out in the open. Like when you say fiat money is what has led to consumerism, and you talk about the high time preference, low time preference, and then you suggest that the financial system is massively bloated because of fiat currency, and that these things wouldn't be the case under sound money, you get like pushback. People are like, no, that doesn't happen. Or no, this is just capitalism or whatever. But then you turn right around and you look at the very arguments the politicians are making for their spending. What do they say? They say we have to push consumer spending. We need more spending. We need higher GDP. And then the people will turn around and just parrot that. It's like, yeah, we need more spending, so we need to push out more money. That's the very basis of the economic argument that they make, that pushing out more money, that inflating the currency will enforce more spending. It will make people make consumerist choices. They will buy shit they don't need. And what else will they do? They'll invest. They won't be able to just stash their money away in the mattress because that's awful for society. Instead, they will invest in the stock market. They'll put their money in equities and treasuries that they don't understand. They'll give it to a money manager that they now have to trust. They'll put it in some volatile stock market that now acts as a store of value and is insanely overpriced. i.e. it gets bloated and corrupt and becomes so much bigger than it ever needed to be in the first place. The very idea of the financial system is no longer a way to find good investment, it just becomes a way to store wealth that used to money did the job of. It just destroys the value of money and makes everyone seek to find a replacement, which bloats alternative industries. The financial system, equities and corporate assets, real estate, gold, everything else that doesn't need to do that job, that shouldn't have that job. Real estate should be used for people who need to live in it. We have a homeless problem and too many vacant houses. How do you think that happens? That happens because the houses are being used as a store of value, not as a place to live. So if you want to understand why fiat money leads to consumerism and a bloated, short-sighted financial system, they've given you the argument. They say it over and over and over again. We have to encourage spending. How do they do it? Fiat money printing. Lowering of the interest rates, which is exactly the same thing. How do they get people to invest in the stock market? Get rid of deflation. Evil deflation means that people don't invest. They explain that this is exactly what they are trying to avoid. A frugal, long-term, patient economy that has savings and doesn't have the need to dump all of their money into a money manager or equities that they don't know anything about or have to become traders on the stock market just to have a retirement. Their arguments are proof that that's exactly what it does. Otherwise, they're wrong. There's a great quote in this piece that just hits this idea just straight on the head. Quote, "Two great evils have emerged from fiat currencies and government-led measurements of economic progress. Consumerism and short-sighted financial engineering. It bloats and corrupts the financial system, puts them in charge of multiples of the capital that should be under their guidance, and it destroys frugality, patience, and savings. It leads to instant gratification, frivolous expenditures, i.e. consumerism." And this is literally its explicitly stated purpose. They just put it in nicer sounding words, but that's what it means to encourage spending when consumers don't want to spend. It means they buy shit they don't need. They're explicitly saying people aren't buying stuff because they don't need it. Obviously, they would buy it otherwise, so we need to encourage them to spend more. Same thing with the investment. We must encourage them to invest in stuff they don't want to invest in. This is what you get. Now, one of the really interesting things that he brings up that I don't think I've ever really addressed in my discussions on this is advertising. And that's something that's so interesting because that is a consequence of the consumerist culture. When you've made a systemic corruption of the money that leads to consumerism, well, then it fuels a multiplication of the advertising industry. And rather than being a social media company, the greater money is in funneling, controlling, and directing advertising. It becomes more profitable to manipulate people because everybody is so focused on short-term instant gratification. There's simply no market for long-term thought. There is simply no market for savings. Like right now, go open a bank account. Go open a savings account and look at what the interest rate is. It's like 0.01%. Do you realize that if we had a sound money, that would mean that 0.01% is the incentive they have to loan money out, which means nobody would put money in the bank. Nobody. Nobody has a savings account because there is no interest rate to be made. The poor people are turning around and buying crap. First, you can't make anything. 0.01% just means that you're losing money every single year. If you save, you're stupid. In that environment, if you save money in fiat, in a savings account, in a bank, you're dumb. Naturally, it would be the best way to make your life more secure and better for your family over the long term. In this unnatural environment, it becomes the dumbest investment choice you could make. It is a way to guarantee a loss and have the capital that you have already produced do nothing for you except bleed. And what do the different mindsets of society do? Wealthy people invest and try to figure out how to move it into assets that will pay some sort of a dividend, and poor people get rid of it. They just buy stuff. There is no alternative in their mind. They have no way to look and be like, oh, I can make 5%. I mean, imagine if you had $1,000 saved, and at the end of the year, you got paid $70. You got paid 7% for your savings because we desperately needed savings across the economy, and therefore there was a price to pay for that savings. And even better, that $70 wasn't devalued. The $1,000 still bought you $1,000 worth of stuff. How quickly would the average person's mindset change about savings? Instead, I had I think it was this year, it might have been late 2019, I still actually had a little bit of money in savings, just because you can easily move from one account to the next. So I would often just put the excess into the savings account, which was stupid. It always should have been in Bitcoin. There always was just a little bit extra just in case. And it was hilarious. I got a check in the mail, put a stamp on it and printed it on a piece of paper. This is so stupid. And they sent me a check for like 52 cent, I think, which was my interest on the year. I laughed. I just laughed out loud. I was like, why would you do this? You spent like a dollar at least getting this to me for a paper check. It was so, I was immediately like, why is there any money in here? And I just immediately dumped it into Bitcoin. But I'm a little bit sidetracked here because this is just to show that, you know, people have to get rid of the money. Luckily, I had Bitcoin to put it in, but otherwise I'd be like, I should buy something. Like, I need to get rid of, this is not doing me any good here. And the very incentive, the one market price we have to incentivize savings is vanished. It's just completely gone. It is centrally controlled and set at essentially zero. Of course, there is no savings. Of course, we have a massive debt problem. The price of both are lies. Back to how these fundamental systemic shifts create entire industries that would not exist otherwise. What if advertising were half its size? I mean, if consumerism plummeted, if all of these assets got readjusted and people were actually encouraged to save, it would. There would not be the overhead, the insane margins on advertising would not exist. In a sound money economy, the financial and banking system and advertising industries would not be leading global economic activity. Think about that. The financial system is supposed to be securing real wealth. The advertising industry is supposed to be informing people of actual wealth out there. How could either be bigger than the industries that they are supporting? They are literally side characters to the actual market. It's like a supporting actor. They are literally support industries to real industries, to real wealth. One secures it and the other tells you about it. And yet somehow we have a market where the supporting actors have more screen time than the main stars. It's just so messed up, and it's hard for people to wrap their head around. Like the deeper you get into it, again, the advertising thing was really not something that, like, you suddenly realize that the, you know, surveillance capitalism is so deeply based on those margins. You know, it's kind of like drugs. And I don't mean that in the sense that, obviously, there's the great analogy of, like, when you're living off of debt to debt to debt, and you're paying off your latest debt, like, you know, it's that short-term mindset, and the economy is basically on a drug, and only as long as you keep giving it that drug can you essentially prevent the hangover or the withdrawal. So that's a great analogy, I think, just for what it's like when an economy is fueled by these illusions, these fraudulent price signals. But what I'm referring to here in this scenario is that when the government manipulates the value of these goods, like and drugs being a great one, because their prices, their margins are so high, they are propped up by the war on drugs. So because they are illegal, Their margins are massive and competition is really low. And the cartels can either just shoot their competitors because there's no legitimate market for protection, or they out their competitors to the police. So they get to maintain a really strong monopoly. That's how they become cartels. We saw the exact same thing during alcohol prohibition, and then it fell away after prohibition died. But during prohibition, we had the exact same thing. We had Capone. We had massive, violent cartels around alcohol, which you don't have in a free market. You only have when the government is able to manipulate the price and prop up these massive margins. That's what we have in advertising. We have a massive, propped up consumerist culture that does not naturally exist, that develops this massive margin on cheap crap and supports an advertising industry that is multiples the size as it would naturally be. This leads to surveillance capitalism. This allows that extra expenditure to manipulate and corrupt the relationship between the consumer and the service that they are using. It's just a really interesting way to think about it, and huge thanks to Tibbald for bringing this up, because I'm probably going to be thinking about this for next couple of days. Really great quote. Next one that I've got here in this list. First and foremost, monetary inflation is an expansion of the money supply. Bam. End of story. Inflating the money supply is inflation. And it does not matter whether or not it shows up in the consumer price index or if it shows up in asset price inflation. What it does is lie about the natural prices. So if it doesn't have consumer price inflation, what that means is that consumer prices would have fallen and instead they stay stable. That is still inflation. It would mean that people can't afford consumer goods and don't want to buy consumer goods, therefore their prices should fall naturally and instead they stay high. Even if it's not inflation in the sense that the price rose, it is inflation. It is an incorrect market price propped up through counterfeiting the currency. First and foremost, monetary inflation is an expansion of the money supply. That is always true. End of story. And the only way prices of goods can increase across the economy is for the expansion of the money supply. It's not possible without it. So if any prices are going up in a stable, consistent manner, it is because of the expansion of the monetary supply. Period. It is amazing how many people reject that simple fact. All right, back to some of the points he was making here. This is back to kind of the consumerist ideas. And I'm actually going to read both of these quotes back to back because they're really kind of hit the same ideas. Quote, rationally, if someone knows that saving money for later use will render this money more valuable, so if we're saving money and we know it's going to be worth more, the incentive to not spend it right away is strikingly obvious. So what happens then? Demand for unnecessary items may contract as people reduce their spending. People may start thinking twice about their willingness to spend the money they earned with hard work. Do I really want to buy the latest pair of Nikes or the newest iPhone? The simple shift of mindset seems inconsequential at first, but it leads to a rippling societal change. A complete reversal of the current norms plagued by overconsumption of frivolities. This tiny shift at the base of how we relate to the goods we are going to buy has massive societal impact. Now, to the next quote that really hits a point that so many people lose. Quote, when consumer behavior shifts, producers undoubtedly adapt their output to meet the new demand. If there is a demand shock, prices will plummet until buyers are found. That's the whole point of the price, right? The price adjusts until the buyers actually come back into the market. And back to the quote, such that producers can distribute their past production and readjust their upcoming production cycle to meet lower demand levels. Producing less, entrepreneurs and organizations can focus on quality over volume, which should create more value for the buyers, perhaps willing to pay more for the products and services they are receiving bringing prices back to an equilibrium. This is another major point about how the markets shift in response. If prices continue to fall for things that people consider frivolous or unimportant to purchase and end up saving because they know the value of their money will go up, they end up saving money until they find a really high-quality, long-lasting product. And understand, producers are simply a mirror of the consumer mentality. If they start saving and refusing to buy stuff that doesn't serve the purpose or that is cheap and won't last long, producers shut down those manufacturing lines. They start focusing on quality improvements in products, on major technological steps rather than just this year's model. And no, it does not destroy the economy or destroy jobs. It puts us at a lower price equilibrium. It just means everything gets cheaper, and we stop wasting trillions of dollars in resources on crap, on stuff that people don't need, on advertising, on an ocean of pointless financial products that attempt to recreate the financial security that money serves in society because they broke money and now they have to reinvent it in the financial markets. Using some baskets of commodities or mortgage-backed securities, because obviously there's no risk in any of those. Guess what's supposed to serve that role? Money. That is why money exists. That's what he talks about further down in this article, talking about like real estate, gold, and equities. These things will be repriced. The reason so many, there's a really good, wait, I've got this quote. Hold on one second. Okay, here we go. Fundamental valuation models for the classes of assets exist today and are well understood. Undeniably today, most of these asset classes are deemed to be overpriced by multiple investment managers looking to find value in underpriced assets. So here's the thing. We have valuation models for these, and all of them are now broken. All of them suggest that these assets are overpriced because the prices no longer follow the profit-to-loss ratios. They no longer follow it because they have a monetary premium. And that's the rest of the quote here. Back to it. Truth be told, most of these assets have accrued a monetary premium, which emanates from their respective utility as decent storeholds of wealth. In a sound money environment, these things are not great storeholds of wealth. They have counterparty risk. They have a risk in the fact that businesses go under. Businesses are not reliable places to put money. They are a risk. They are a bet. That's why it's called investment. That's why it's called speculating. But when you break the money, when you destroy the fundamental value proposition of money to simply store wealth over time, they're the next best thing. Real estate gets priced way up. It has a huge monetary premium. And I just talked about the, is it stop calling Bitcoin deflationary argument? Something by Connor Brown, I think. But he talks about how a third of the luxury apartments in New York are empty. Same thing in Vancouver, and Tubal mentions that in this article, that Vancouver has tons of real estate that just sits empty. None of it's being used for housing. This is how you get such a massive divorce between the economy, between the need for housing, and people who now have to use, who price out normal people from shelter because they need a place to park value because you destroyed the money. If you want to talk about why housing is a problem, there it is. That is why. If we didn't need it for store value, if it didn't have to take over the monetary premium because our money is crap, we wouldn't have a housing problem. And housing is now seen as an asset. It's not, it's a liability. It is a liability. It should be used for shelter. Now the whole middle class, the value of the middle class is based on their mortgages. It's based on the value of their houses. That's why the middle class is separate from The lower classes, because they park their money, they buy a house, they actually own a house, and the house value goes up 10% a year. This is simply because debt is so easy to get a hold of, and the pricing is so fraudulent that they'll just print money to buy houses, print money. And of course, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They say, oh, well, we'll keep interest rates low to and allow people to invest in housing at low interest rates because the price of housing goes up. Well, the price of housing is going up because you're keeping interest rates low and letting people invest in housing even though they don't have the money. Of course, the price keeps going up. That's what happens when you print money you don't have and loan it at interest rates that don't make any sense. And this, in my opinion, is where the insane, psychotic, bullish case for Bitcoin rests. And I'll talk about it in just a second as we close out the episode. Just a huge thank you to HexaWallet for supporting the show. I know you're probably sick of hearing about them, but they're a wonderful wallet and an awesome team. I have conversations with Anant over there all the time. Really good guy, and they're building something really cool. Check them out at hexawallet.io. And again, this is what I do. I'm free to answer any questions. So closing this out on the ridiculous bullish case for Bitcoin, and T-Ball mentions this or has a quote really close to the end that kind of explains what this is. Quote, in its early phase of monetization, Bitcoin as a global monetary base may capture significant portions of the aggregated monetary premium accrued by different asset classes over the last decades of fiat currency experimentation. As these asset classes are repriced by markets free of artificial fiat money inflation, purchasing power will be restored to the people. All that margin in the advertising industry, all of that margin in the financial markets, all of the margin above the valuation models for all of those corporate equities, all the companies that literally print losses every year and yet are worth billions and billions of dollars, all of the products that people normally wouldn't buy, all of the inflated premiums in housing because people are just buying to flip or buying in order to store value for some short span of time, all that excess premium in gold is going to be corrected because Bitcoin exists. In a sound money environment, those premiums are unsustainable. They only exist because we have crap money. As soon as it is understood and it becomes widespread that we have good money in the economy, those premiums vanish, because they are unsustainable when money works. And this is the thought process that makes you realize, and when you think about it, it's a $10 trillion market cap in Bitcoin is underpriced. And all it has to do is work as consistent, independent, global, sound money. It literally simply has to survive. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to all my patrons for supporting the show. And I'll catch you next time on Bitcoin Audible. Until then, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.